everyone, welcome to the Front Stretch Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Albino. And as always, I'm here with my co-host, Mike Neff.
And how you doing?
Neff, we're here to break down a busy weekend of racing at Darlington Raceway. Throwback weekend as that, which saw Kevin Harvick clinch a spot in the round of 12. We'll also discuss the epic Xfinity Series race on Saturday. I had a lot of fun watching that race, wrote about it, had a ton of fun. And we'll also have a conversation with Matt DiBenedetto coming up at the end of the show, which I'll preface by saying, Neff, it was prior to his 21st place finish in the Southern 500.
It's probably a good thing.
Probably a good thing, because it was a bad day for Matty D on Sunday night. But I feel like, Neff, we got to start this off by talking about something I don't necessarily want to. And maybe we differ. Maybe you liked the Cup Darlington race. We haven't talked about it. But I thought it was very hard to pass. The aero package, it's tough. But compared to the Xfinity Series race over the past 2 years, not just at Darlington, but in general, I mean, it's so night and day, the package. And we know that. We've talked about it ad nauseum on here. But there was no better example of it, in my opinion, than this weekend.
I'm with you. We've beaten it like a dead horse. And I mean, I don't even know if we need to belabor it much, but just with these cars on the ground on that racetrack, it's so aero-dependent when you get up behind somebody. It just takes forever to get by them. And you had a few guys kind of take some tire strategy calls, but I don't know that it ended up paying off the way they thought it would, because the caution came a little bit early there at the end. So it was, again, it's Darlington. I will always love Darlington. I don't care if I see Ned Jarrett win by 14 laps. It's still Darlington. I'm still going to love it. But at the same time, yeah, it was a little disappointing, I guess, because, and I'm trying to remember, I want to say it was 3, maybe 4 years ago when they rolled out the low downforce package for the first time at Darlington. That race was amazing.
It was.
Kevin Harvick, Keselowski, Dylan.
Carl Edwards.
It was so awesome. And now this year it was another intermediate race for the most part, but you still had people there, which was fantastic, having some fans. The throwback schemes are awesome. So I was happy, and I love that it's 500 miles for all you people whining that it needs to be shorter. I'd just take a leap. It's a crown jewel, and it should never be shorter. And yeah, I was happy about it. I loved it on Labor Day. I wish they would run it in the daytime, because I think that would have made a bit of a difference. But in the end, it is what it is, and I'll keep watching.
I agree with you with the fans aspect. It was nice to see 8,000 fans back. Kevin Harvick said that was his first win out of his 8 wins this year, that there's been fans in the stands, which was nice to see. And also the throwback schemes. Obviously, we talked about our favorites last week going in, but there was, you know, as the week went on, more got introduced, whether it's Cup, Xfinity, or Trucks, and there were some really nice ones this year, but
I couldn't believe there were some people poo-pooing Jimmy's paint scheme.
I don't know.
People are drunk, man. That was an awesome paint
scheme. I think that's one of the best paint schemes ever, and that's recency bias, but it was so nice. I can't agree with those folks, but I don't want to, you know, harp on the package too much, but it was hard to pass. I mean, we saw that, and we'll talk about it in depth here in a bit, but you know, Kyle Busch, when he got back in the back, or Denny Hamlin, for instance, top three all night, the entire night. And then he gets back during a debatable caution that we'll talk about as well. Couldn't make it past 13th. He finished 13th.
Yeah.
So
it was amazing.
At his, arguably his best track. So I just, it's hard to pass with this package. It doesn't matter the track. But it was still entertaining at times, which we'll definitely get into at the high moment of the race. With 15 laps to go. But before we get into that, Neff, Harvick got his 8th victory of the season. And it seemed like this week he didn't have a winning race car. Maybe 3rd to 6th, 7th at times, maybe further back. But he capitalized on a mistake for Martin Truex Jr., and we'll talk about that. But it seems like everything's just falling the way of the 4 team this year.
Well, and it's even, and you heard him talk about it as soon as he took the checkered flag, about what a battle it was.
Mm-hmm.
And post-race, talking to the crew chief and to him, you know, they both made the comment that they weren't on Sunday night. And they had to battle through and make some changes and make some stuff work. And, you know, you often hear those discussions about championship defining moments, and it may be a moment where you get a couple laps down and you work back to get on a lead lap or whatever. I feel like this was a championship defining moment for Harvick, that they weren't good. They persevered through it, put themselves in the right position. So when the top two had a malfunction, then they ended up taking advantage of it. And in all honesty, I think if it went another five laps, I don't think Harvick wins, because I think Austin Dillon was going to pass him.
Yeah, Austin Dillon was definitely, he was coming, and he made up like 0.8 over the final two or three laps. And yeah, I think if it was maybe one or two more laps, even, I think he might, you know, it might have been a different outcome. But, you know, I'm looking at the Harvick stats this year, and they're astonishing. They're great, right? Over almost 1,150 laps led, eight wins, 18 top fives, 22 top tens, and 27 starts, 6.4 average finish, which is the best of any driver in any season, I believe since 2010. I saw a stat on that from at Fathead, P-H-A-T, head on Twitter. But yeah, he's won four out of the past seven races, and it seems like three of those were in dominating fashion. The two Michigan races, where he has the unbeatable car, it seems like. It's 3-for-3, including Indy. And then Dover, where he led 223 of 311 laps. It's just, I mean, he's been with Rodney Childers now for, what, 7 years? They're just getting better. And the older he gets, the better he's getting, which usually is, you know, not the case when you're in your mid-40s.
Yeah, you got to wonder. I mean, most everybody in modern times, let's say the last 20 to 30 years, once you get across that 40 threshold, the reflexes start going, and it's just, I mean, Father Time is undefeated. You always hear that in any sporting endeavor. But it's been amazing for Harvick. The last couple, 3 years, it seems like he's gotten better. And as you said, he and Ronnie together just seem like they really are, they're like sharing a brain. You know, they're always on the same page. They're always going together. And we talk periodically on here about the mental aspects of this sport. And I honestly think Harvick has made leaps and bounds in that aspect in the last handful of years. And I don't know if it's because of him being a father. I don't know if it's because of him getting rid of his racing enterprises, so he focused solely back on racing. But whatever it is, you don't have those Harvick meltdowns that you used to have when a lug nut was left loose or a tire got away or whatever. It just seems as though maturity has set in, and that has put him in a different frame of mind across entire races. And I feel like that has really benefited him. And, you know, 2 years ago, I would have thought he's getting ready to retire after this year. Now I think 5 years is not out of the question after this
one. Yeah, I think, I want to say it was former French Dutch writer Joel Wolken, who now is doing some freelance work with Forbes. He talked to Harvick and Childers a couple weeks ago, and I think he was the one that said Harvick, and I think it's been reported elsewhere, talked to Joe Girardi, who is now the Philadelphia Phillies manager, used to be the New York Yankees, won the 2009 World Series as their manager. And, you know, they've established a friendship. Harvick's a Yankees fan. He threw out the first pitch a few times in Yankee Stadium, and he went to him, and Girardi's like, why retire when you're on top, when you're still winning? And that's what Harvick's doing. I mean, and on the flip side of what you said about kind of his emotional outbursts in the past, you also don't see stuff usually like this weekend where he gets on the radio and he's screaming after the win, you know, in the thrill of victory. So, he's just getting better and better. And, he, you know, he's tied now. His season high over his career, his 20th year in for career wins in a season, both of which are in the last 3 years with eight.
And he passed Kyle Busch for 9th on the all-time list.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's getting 10 this year. There's 9 races to go. He's won 4 of the past 7. He's got to win.
How can he not?
Yeah, he's got to win 2 of the last 9. Right?
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to see him get to 13, in all honesty. I mean, there's no reason that he can't.
Yeah, I mean, he's won 4 of 7. That'd be 5 of 9. I wouldn't put it past the 4 team right now, because they're hitting on all cylinders. And if there was any question going into the playoffs, you know, obviously they started last week, that he wouldn't make it to Phoenix, he's now got 62 playoff points.
basically sit out a race.
He keeps racking them up. So, I would say the four team is essentially a lock now, as it was before probably Darlington, for Phoenix.
I still wonder, and I have to imagine because of the commitments with sponsors and what have you, that they wouldn't do it. But I could almost see, because the Anheuser-Busch guys liking to think outside of the box, can you imagine if he gets to Martinsville and he's got 80 points? And, you know, he's got 80 points over second place, so he's already guaranteed to be to the Final Four. They take the green flag, and he comes around and parks it in a pit stall on the first lap, and they all put on flannel shirts and sit there and drink Busch beer on Pillay and just enjoy the show. I mean, something like that would just be such a cool thing to do, because it would be so out of the box, and I think your sponsor might actually get more exposure out of that than him winning in Martinsville. But I don't know. I think that would be an awesome way to kind of cap off the playoffs before he headed to Phoenix.
Anheuser-Busch does an incredible job of implementing their sponsors in different ways. We saw Harvick run a bunch of different paint schemes last year, this year. So that would be funny. But
now, are we getting corn cans this weekend? I saw that they came out with the Busch corn cans. So
wouldn't be surprised.
I feel like there should be a corn-painted car this weekend.
We'll see. I do not see that happening at Martinsville. I mentioned the incident earlier with Martin Truex Jr. So I want to bring that up, Neff. He attempted to pass Chase Elliott with, I believe it was 15 laps to go. Ultimately, he cleared himself.
He passed him.
Yeah, he cleared himself when he wasn't clear. He probably had another 6 inches to a foot maybe to clear him. After the race, didn't really apologize and saying he thought Elliott would have given him the position. But with 15 to go, a crown jewel race, Southern 500 on the line, I can't blame Elliott for not getting out of the gas and letting Truex. If Truex gets by, he's gone. He wins the race.
Yep.
So, I mean, you can't do that. So, I think this was just a racing incident, but ultimately, both drivers paid a pretty big deal from it.
Yeah, I agree, and we talked about this before we started the podcast. I don't blame either one of them. I mean, Truex had a run. Yes, he's probably going to get another run like that if he's running it out to the finish, but you don't know.
Right.
And, you know, the bottom line was Chase made a mistake going to the bottom in 3 and 4 to try and see if there was some speed down there, and there wasn't. And that gave Truex a humongous run, but Hendrick Power kicked in on a straightaway, so he didn't clear him going into one, and he thought he was. And so, like you said, if Chase lets him go, he's gone. If Chase doesn't let him go, they wreck, and they end up wrecking. And, you know, you say wreck, they both kept rolling, but it damaged both their cars.
They were wrecked.
Much put them out. I don't blame either one of them. I don't know that there should be any hard feelings other than the fact that Chase Elliott's got to be about done dealing with JGR driving.
Right, at Darlington, too.
Taken out twice at Darlington, once at Martinsville by the entire stable. The only one left to get a piece of him is Eric Jones, and I'm willing to bet somewhere along the line Eric Jones has probably screwed up one of his days, too. So I don't – yeah, it was a race deal, and I don't blame either one of them, but at the same time – man, it could have been interesting if Truex had backed off enough for them to go side by side all the way through 1 and 2.
Yeah, and I think we saw that. And even with this, with the cup package, I think those, I mean, if you get into, and I get that he cleared himself, but we saw it like in the Xfinity race on Saturday, Noah Gragson, he made a move under Ross Chastain. The car still got loose. So when you go into turn one, especially, because it's a narrow exit off two, there's.
And going into one.
Yeah, and going into one.
On the face car ride along over there, you go into one. I'm like, how do they fit one car in this corner, let alone two of them? It looks like it's 6 feet wide when you go into turn one.
Yeah, you gotta have balls to make it, you know, a move going into one and then off of two, like I was mentioning. So, you know, ultimately the flip side of what you were saying is at the end, if Truex, if he waits, I think he does get another run, but you don't know. You can't, you know, predict the future at the time or go back and think of what could happen. But I think he gets another run. Ultimately, what happens, though, is he has to pit, drops to 20th in the running order, the finishing order. Elliott drops to 20th. I don't know if Chase, I'm assuming he pitted. TV didn't show it if he did or not. But Anyways, now Truex, if he say he finishes second, Elliott goes on to wins, which I think it would have been the opposite. But he would have been 36 points above the cut line going into Richmond. Now he's only 16, and Chase Elliott's only 12 above. So these, I mean, you know, we're in the playoffs. This could be costly with only two races going in the round of 16.
Yeah, I mean, it most definitely put both of them in a situation that is not ideal, and they could have been sitting pretty fat and happy going into Richmond. Instead, now they got to be a little more stressed about it. But again, win in advance, so the opportunity is there before you, and at least we're not doing a crapshoot race like Daytona to get to the next round.
And nothing's guaranteed in racing, but I think Truex, you know, he's had, coming into this race, 8 straight top 4 finishes. I think he's sick of finishing 2nd through 4th. So he needed to make a move. And with the consistency that the team's had, I don't think he's really, and, you know, he's dominated at Richmond over the past really 4 years. Granted, he's only won there twice, but, I mean, he's probably going to be the car to beat this weekend. So, I mean, he had a dominating performance this weekend at Darlington, but I don't know. Those points could be costly because Bristol's not his best racetrack, probably one of his worst. It's tough because, I mean, these are two of the, I'd say, 6 favorites for the championship.
Yeah, you gotta figure that they're at least in the conversation going into this thing, and now they're both, I mean, I shouldn't say comfortable, but they're at least above the line. It'd be worse if they were below the cutoff line at this point in time. But, again, Richmond, there are those that argue that it's not, but I will always argue that it's a short track because it's less than a mile. Anything can happen. I mean, you got dudes running side by side, lap after lap there, because that's one of the things I love about Richmond is it's so hard to complete a pass even when we didn't have the package. And you'll spend 10, 15, 20 laps trying to pass somebody, and you put one wheel wrong and it hits a sidewall and cuts a tire, you know, your day can end in a hurry. So they would much rather be 30-some points ahead than 16 or 12, but they're at least still on a positive side looking up.
But I can't blame Chase for not letting Truex buy. And I can't blame Truex for going for it. And I mean, let's face it. One of Truex's, I feel like, downfalls of his career is maybe his, I don't want to say lack of aggressiveness, but lack of aggressiveness. There's a lot of times where he, you know, drivers kind of make fun of him for complaining on the radio. People make fun of him for complaining on the radio for whining and lap traffic and whatnot. He kind of expects you just to let him buy at times, but he manned up in this deal, and unfortunately it cost both of them. But I don't know what it says. I mean, I think it makes a statement that Truex's not just going to lay over anymore, because I mean, let's think of it 2 years ago with the championship. Well, first at Martinsville, and he got moved out of the way by Joey Logano, and you know, he promised, he said he ain't going to win the championship. Well, he went on and won the championship and passed Truex for the championship.
Yeah.
So maybe, I don't know, maybe this is a new version of Truex 2.0 or something.
We'll find out. It'll be a little different in Phoenix than it was at Homestead, but it's still pretty high speed there to be just taking somebody out if the opportunity presents itself. But who knows? I mean, I'm with you. That's always been one of those things, you know. I mean, Mark Martin was about the worst at it, but you know, Truex has always had that on him too, that he just doesn't get aggressive enough at times when you think he should.
Mm-hmm.
And it ends up costing him. And I've always said that about Mark Martin. If he'd have stepped up and roughed some guys up instead of worrying about his reputation, he'd have 2 or 3 championships. So it may be that point's come to Truex that he's just sick of it. He may also see that career clock is closer to the end than the beginning. So you know, he may be looking at that the opportunities to win a championship are getting shorter, and he needs to take advantage of it. I guess we will find out in the not-too-distant future if those two end up anywhere near each other or anybody else ends up in a position where he's got to rough them up to get by.
Yeah, and those two are by far the best cars on Sunday night. They both led well over 100 laps. So, I mean, I don't think we're going to see I think we're just going to see this continue in the playoffs, and that was the first race of 10. We're in the round of 16. The aggressiveness and the intensity is just going to pick up as we get closer to Phoenix. But
absolutely.
Neff, it's funny because Chase dominated the early portion of the race. Granted, Truex got by for 2 stage wins. And he really fell off in the middle, I think at the end of stage one, middle stage two or whatever. But I don't even know how to describe this, but a caution came out during the middle of green flag pit stops. And it was a debatable caution for some. I know I was listening to Clint Bowyer's spotter, and he's like, what the hell is the caution for? The piece of metal is 100 feet off the racing surface. And I mean, NBC showed the cameras where there was a piece.
I don't know that it was 100 feet off when four different cars hit it.
Right. NBC showed that multiple cars hit it, and maybe then it went off the racing surface. I don't know if NBC ever showed where they picked it up from. But with that said, it was during a cycle of green flag pit stops where, you know, if a car spins or something, it's going to bring out a caution. But especially at Darlington, it's a hard pit road to get on. As we saw during the same cycle, Denny Hamlin missed pit road.
Yep.
But some drivers in the final stage were, splitting it into thirds, so pitting twice, and others were splitting it down the middle, pitting once. So you had Kevin Harvick, Chase Elliott get out front, and they had ginormous leads. And then this piece of debris happened, falls off one of the cars. I think it was a crash panel, and it causes a caution. And it shifts the running order. You know, I mentioned earlier with Denny Hamlin, yes, he missed pit road, but he also, I mean, this caution didn't help him because fresh tires at Darlington are worth a shit ton.
Yes, so, 2.5 seconds a lap.
Yeah, so when you're losing that much per lap, I think Hamlin was nearly a lap down, if not a lap down. What's your opinion on this caution getting thrown out right in the middle of green flag pit stops?
You know as well as I do that I am no apologist for NASCAR when it comes to BS cautions.
Absolutely.
But I thought that was absolutely a valid caution. I mean, you have what was obviously a jagged piece of metal. It wasn't going to be confused for duct tape or a plastic bag or something. It was blatantly obvious that it was a piece of metal that got hit by at least three and I think four race cars that they showed on TV. I don't know how many others hit it that weren't on TV. You can't not throw a caution flag for that. I understand it's in the middle of green flag stops and you don't really want to dramatically impact the running order, but you had to. I mean, you can't have a large piece of metal that could easily cut through a tire just bounce around on a racetrack. And yeah, it may have ended up 100 feet out of the groove by the time they picked it up, but it was not leaving the groove as those cars were hitting it. And yeah, I will call NASCAR to Matt many times over BS cautions because we see them all the time, but I thought this one was completely justified.
And yeah, I definitely agree with you. Excuse me. And yes, we've torn NASCAR apart some weeks for BS cautions that they throw. Bristol comes to mind when you're scratching the wall and they throw the caution. But yeah, this one, if there's a piece of metal on the track, even if it's out of the racing groove, I think it's, I don't know, it probably should be deemed a caution. Especially at Darlington, even though Darlington, there's, like you mentioned earlier, the line, the racing groove there is very narrow. So maybe even if they weren't going to use wherever the debris was, maybe, I don't know, maybe they should have thrown the caution regardless. So
yep.
I think NASCAR did anything wrong. It did suck for those drivers like Hamlin, who also cost himself though, after Jimmy Johnson got into the rear of him. I guess Jimmy didn't realize he was coming to pit road, and there was some damage to the right rear of Hamlin's car, but once he got back in traffic, it wasn't the same for anyone.
Right.
Kyle Busch, too, I think he got in the back because of that. Truex, fortunately for him, made his way up, but then, as we just talked about, what happened there. But on the flip side of that, Neff, it helped other drivers out, which, good for them.
Yep.
That's
how it works.
One of those drivers is Austin Dillon, who you mentioned earlier. He started the back, as did Ryan Blaney, but for Austin Dillon, it's kind of something that you don't see happen a lot. But, going through inspection, they had the left front tire on the right side and the right front tire on the left side. So they were reversed. They had to change those. And he mentioned it's a good thing they caught it before, because if not, they probably would have knocked the wall down in turn one. Which we saw that last year in the championship race with Martin Truex Jr. I think it also happened maybe in this race with Ryan Blaney later on, which we'll discuss here in a bit. But it's happened more often than not, I would say, in the last year. But good run for Dillon coming back to finish second. Huge kind of statement to start the playoffs.
Yeah, I've never, and I've heard of it being done many times, and I've never understood it, how putting tires on the wrong side of the car, usually everything I've ever read on it always helped it. And I mean, there's a famous story in, I want to say it was 1990, when Earnhardt and Mark Martin were going at it for the championship. They went down to test at Atlanta like 3 weeks before the final race of the season, when the championship was still a close battle. And Roush brought like two different cars, and they had like 20 some people there, and they were just thrashing to try to find speed. Earnhardt's gang shows up, they unload the car, they put left side tires on the right side, and went out and ripped a lap that was like a second faster than the track record at the time, pulled into the pits and sat there and ate ice cream the rest of the day, and just laughed at the Roush guys trying to catch up to them. I don't know what it is that I've heard stories that go both ways, where they put the tires on the wrong side and the car's got awful, and I've heard them put them on the wrong side and it's ridiculously fast. Because these tires are directional, and if you have them going the opposite direction of what they're designed to, they supposedly will go really fast for a very short period of time and then just like completely fall apart. So, yeah, I promise you they didn't do that on purpose. But at the same time, that's another one of those you're like, how the hell did we manage to do that? Because there's arrows on the tire. So if you're paying any kind of attention to putting it on, that's kind of dumb. But
he also mentioned that there's Sharpies, you know, like LF and RF.
Yeah, they write RF, LF, RR, LR on the tire, along with the inches of circumference so that you get the staggers proper.
So, yeah.
I don't know how that happened.
The fact a team can miss that prior to tech is I don't know. It's kind of just a stupid mistake, but in the end, I mean,
we saw Denny Hamlin dumping tungsten on a racetrack, too. I still can't grasp how that happens.
Sure. But regardless, you know, Dylan's playoff started off really good with a second-place finish. That's only his fourth podium finish of his career. Fifth. He's got three wins, a second, and a third. He and RCR have been impressive this year. I know he finished 18th in the regular season in points, but he also missed a race, from having COVID for the Daytona Road Course, so he accumulated 0 points. Not that that mattered, because he'd already won by that point.
Right.
But, I mean, he's sneaky, and he feels that he's a dark horse for the playoffs, and he feels like this is the best RCR's been with him being in the playoffs, thus being his fourth year. So, who knows, maybe he sneaks by, and I think 99% of brackets probably had him out in the first round.
Right. Yeah, he's a crown jewel guy, too.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean,
he likes these long races.
He's won Daytona. He's won 600. Charlotte. I mean, he shows up in big moments, and if he manages somehow to get it to Phoenix, you never know what might happen. But, yeah, it's been interesting to me how well he and Justin Alexander have done this year, because he and Justin were okay, not great, and so they did the old get the band back together with Danny Stockman, and they didn't recapture the magic. And now, lo and behold, Justin comes back, and poof, they all season long, I think they've been running better. And we talked to him when we had our chance to interview him, that whether he'll truly admit it or not, Tyler Reddick is pushing him. Because Reddick's come in here and is doing good, and if Dylan doesn't step it up, then he's got nobody to blame but himself when Reddick's getting a lot of speed out of the car. But I think just the groups they've got working right now, just in general, I think have helped bring RCR up a notch for everybody because they've found speed.
Yeah, and Dylan mentioned kind of what you said. He crown jewel, he lets the race come to him. All of his podium finishes that I mentioned have been 500 miles or more. So, yeah, he's good with the long races. And he kind of attributed that to learning and being methodical growing up and being competitive, whether it's in the Little League World Series or, you know, playing. He mentioned pickleball with his father. He's just competitive. And the longer something goes, the better he's at, it seems. And he thinks the same. So, he's sneaky. And I think if there's 2-3 more laps, he would have been locked into the round of 12.
Yeah, I think so too.
For sure. Now, a couple other guys that I had out in my first round after the round of 16, Alex Bowman and William Byron both had solid finishes, 5th and 6th. Bowman at times looked like he had a car who could maybe contend for top three, four. Ultimately, like I said, finished sixth. And then you had Byron, who was out to lunch in the middle portion of the race. He was 18th, battling for 18th, NBC showed, and got his third straight top five. So those are two other drivers that are, I mean, if you put top fives together in the first round, I don't see you missing the round of 12.
Yeah, and I mean, that was the formula for success for the longest time when we had the chase format, was if you could average a fifth place finish, you're going to, that just didn't happen, that you got better than that. So I feel like the same thing here. If you're pointing your way through at least the first two rounds, you're going to be able to move on. Now, getting to the final four on points is a different animal. Yeah. If you've come in like Dylan or like Byron, these guys that have one or two playoff points, if any, or five from a win, mm-hmm. you're not gonna point your way in unless a bunch of people have catastrophic developments in that round of eight. So at that point, you got to get there. But for the round of 16 and round of 12, if you can average a fifth place finish, you're going to advance.
Right. And let's face it, both these drivers struggled during the summer. At times, you wonder if William Byron is just going to throw away his 16th seed because he was on all summer and, you know, he ends up winning the regular season finale. Bowman was really good at the beginning of the season and then had a stretch of nine races at one point during the summer where he had one top 10. So now they both have three top 10s in a row, and it seems like them and Hendrick as a whole starting to get hot. We mentioned Chase Elliott led over 100 laps earlier. Jimmy at times the other night, obviously he's not in the playoffs, but he was good too. I think he had one of the best cars early on. So maybe Hendrick's getting some of that speed back from earlier in the season. And we're going to a lot of the tracks that we visited earlier in the season too, like Darlington. So on the flip side, Neff, Team Penske had an up and down night, specifically though with Ryan Blaney.
Mostly down.
Yeah. You had Keselowski who hit the wall, pounded the wall, somehow came back to finish 11th, got saved by a green flag, a caution during green flag pit stops. I can't spit it out here. Not the debris caution, a different one. He ended up staying out late and got saved by that caution. Joey Logano, he finished third with his left rear quarter panel destroyed from getting hit by LaJoy on a pile up during a restart, you know, mid race or so. But then you had the flip side. You had Matt DiBenedetto, who struggled all night long, Neff. At times, he got lapped twice, fell to 29th on the scoreboard. And if, you know, NBC had that onboard that looked straight at him, and you could see his eyes and the way he's muscling the car around. And, you know, Matt's a big guy, he's a strong guy, and he definitely got a workout on Sunday night.
Yeah, In all honesty, I felt like something might have been broken on that car because
it was bad.
I mean, it was so bad. It's one thing to be bad, but I mean, it was legitimately like, I don't know if it had a bad shock, if it had a loose A-arm or something, but I mean, it seriously looked like something was like legitimately broken, not just poorly set up. And they thrashed on it all night. And yeah, they clawed back a little ways, but yeah, as nights go, he and Blaney, they want to erase that tape and go on. They don't even want to look back at that.
Yeah, and I guess you could say he rebounded to 21st because that's probably the best he ran all night. I was listening to his radio for the majority of the night, or a lot of the race, and you could just tell how down he was, saying the car's terrible, I don't know what to do. So maybe there was something broke. Because you don't – Darlington's one of his better tracks too. I think he had two of his last three finishes were inside the top 10 there. So, yeah, to see him struggle was it's a bad start to the playoffs. And he's a guy that comes into the playoffs with zero playoff points, the 16 yep. seed. A lot of people have him out. I mean, he's got his work cut out for him now, 17 down, as does Ryan Blaney, who his playoffs got off to about as bad as you could get off to. And it started by receiving a 10-point penalty prior to the green flag, losing Todd Gorin because there was a – I listened to Todd on SiriusXM radio Monday morning. There was a 5-pound bag of lead that was left, I believe, on the radiator. And it's just something that they do at the shop. And then no one at the track, it must have fell down like underneath in the suspension behind the splitter, Todd said. and no one caught it, and NASCAR did. And ultimately, that lost them 10 points, which are valuable because now both DiBenedetto and Blaney are 17 out.
Yeah, that's, again, we see more and more of this stuff going on because of, and I don't want to blame it all on no practice, no qualifying, but it feels like there's checklists that are not being properly gone through. Yeah. Because you're limited on the amount of time that you're around the cars. You get guys, they put bags of lead in the driver's seat a lot of times when they're setting the cars up because they want to mimic the driver's weight. You know, I don't know if they were doing something from a pull-down rig standpoint or whatever that they wanted that bag of lead to help push the nose down, but it just seems odd that at this level there's not part of a checklist that goes through and you acknowledge that all bags of lead are back where they belong, you know, before you roll a car into the hauler. Unless, you know, you have one on there specifically to put it in the hauler. But it's really odd, and it's especially odd for Penske. And this is the second or third time now this year that we've seen just gross mistakes when it comes to getting the car ready for race day. And it's very un-Penske-like. And I feel like I feel like there's some really tough competition meetings going on over there, and it's, you got to have some big cojones to be able to look at Roger and explain to him why you left a bag of lead sitting on a radiator.
Yeah, and this comes from a driver in Blaney who's shown a lot of speed really since he's been with Penske, but for whatever reason only has a few wins to show for it. So he's never won two races in a year, and we're going to Richmond now where it's by far his worst track on the circuit. He's got a best finish of there of 17th in eight races. His average finish is 25.5. So now he's 17 points out in the round of 16, a round that he should breeze through, and he's 17 out going to his worst track. I mean, that's kind of a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, not a recipe for good luck.
So he might be in a must-win going into Bristol. And, you know, I've talked to him at Richmond before, and you could just tell that he hates that track. For whatever reason, he can't figure it out. It doesn't matter how well his teammates are running with Logano and Keselowski. He just can't figure it out. So
yeah, Logano's really good there.
And Keselowski has his moments. He led 383 of 400 laps 1 year. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of, you know, Blaney's a guy who, on media day last week, I think it was Hamlin. Hamlin said he's a real dark horse to get to the final four. But then he has mistakes like this, and it's, granted, it's not the driver's doing, it's the team doing. And like you said, a simple checklist, checking everything over twice this wouldn't have happened. Now he's 17 out, so it's going to be tough. If he misses the round of
battle for sure.
If he misses the round of 12, that's not a good look. Nope. Plain and simple. So, anything else on the Cup race enough before we get to talking about a good Xfinity race?
No, just really thankful to see fans in the stands, and man, I know people may not like it, but I hope we get two Darlington races next year.
Yeah, and so I don't know when the 2021 schedule is going to be out. It seems like it's near done, but then you have moves like today, which we'll talk about, which, you know, aren't for next year. But I don't know. It seems like there's going to be some changes for next year. So maybe two races at Darlington's one.
And Phelps even made it sound like they're not planning on releasing the whole schedule.
Yes.
It's going to come out in pieces because you don't know what we're going to have next year still. There are 2021 events in other places, other sports, what have you, that are already getting canceled for next year. So, you know, you don't know where we're going to be with a vaccine. It seems like everybody's hanging their hat on this damn vaccine. But until that happens, there's a distinct possibility we may not be back racing in California or New York again next year.
Yeah, and until there is a vaccine, I was on a conference call or a Zoom call with Phelps last week. Until there's a vaccine, no media seems like going to be allowed in the track, have access. So, you know, that's obviously selfishly we need more access, we want more access. But they also can't afford the drivers to get COVID and miss races. So, Yeah, it's a tough deal for everybody. But regardless, we're here to talk about the Xfinity Series now, Neff, because this race, in my opinion, from start to finish, is about as good as stock car racing can get.
It was good. Ain't gonna lie, I'm with you on that one. It was an exciting event, to say the least.
And it started off in the first stage. So Denny Hamlin runs one Xfinity race seemingly every year, sometimes two or three. But for the last couple of years, it's been one. Always at Darlington. He has a good...
Always wins.
Or always in contention to win. Or he gets disqualified like he did last year. Cole Custer gets the victory. This year, starts last and wins the first stage by 5 seconds. So you're thinking, uh-oh, if there's no stage breaks today, Hamlin's lapping the field. But that turned out not to be the case. He, you know, in stage two, he ran second to fifth, ended up winning it with a pass with a few laps to go. But then, Neff, the final stage was incredible. And there were some, you know, events that led up to a great finish. One being oil being down on the track, which we'll talk about here in a little bit. But the last 20 laps, when the green flag flew, Ross Chastain and Denny Hamlin, that was, I think, probably the best 20 laps of racing this year.
It was awesome. I mean, and unfortunately, it ended up neither of them winning, which is, you know, kind of similar to the Cup race when it was all said and done. But, yeah, it was, I mean, just dudes that just were going for it. And, you know, again, we've heard it from Ross before. He does get paid to finish second.
Yeah.
So he's doing everything he can to win. Denny's not running for points, so he's doing everything he can to win because that's all he's there for. And Brandon Jones puts himself in a position to where if those two screw up, he's good. And sure enough, they screwed up.
Yeah, so Brandon Jones, first off, Denny Hamlin and Ross Chastain are putting on a hell of a battle. And Hamlin's wearing the rear end off of Chastain, trying to force him to make a mistake. And Chastain, you know, he wasn't quivering. He wasn't making any mistakes. And so while they get racing hard, Jones comes from like 4 seconds back, and he's closing in. And I'm thinking, like, he might win this race because you could tell how hard the front two are racing. And then they start swapping paint, slide jobbing one another, and then coming to the white flag.
Slide job!
Hamlin throws a huge slide job on Chastain, and he gets into the fence. Chastain's already in the fence, and, you know, couldn't avoid Hamlin, hit him in the left rear. I don't know how they didn't wreck, but Jones gets by for his third victory of the year. It was just, that's Darlington at its finest, and that's NASCAR at its finest, is the Xfinity Series on Saturday. And like I said, from start to finish, I think probably the best race in NASCAR all year.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I love seeing cars that slide around on an old, worn-out racetrack. Absolutely. Where tires make a difference, and guys just going for it. I mean, it was everything you wanted in a race. And I hope we get to see it twice next year.
And I was curious because, you know, Ross has been so close. I think that was his fourth runner-up finishes, but he has all these top tens this year. Probably the most consistent driver in Xfinity, but yet still doesn't have, you know, he doesn't have a win yet. So I asked him, like, is racing like this, is it like Saturday and at Daytona, is it fun or is it frustrating? And he says it's all circumstantial. You know, if he said Saturday, it's fun. If it's Daytona and you take out a teammate, not fun. He said Talladega was fun. He pushed his teammate to a victory there, or raced his teammate for a victory there. But there's been so many instances this year where he's had probably the best car, if not best two cars, and he can't get it done. I do think, though, he's getting the championship four. Like we talked about with Justin Haley last week, colleagues just upped its game so much this year, and really even last year, and it's just set up for success. So I would say at least one of them gets in the final four.
I agree. Yeah, and Justin said it last week that if a colleague doesn't have at least one car in the final four, they're going to be pissed.
Yeah.
And I don't blame them. And we said it last week, I still feel like colleague of any Xfinity team that is not a Cup team already, I think they are in the best shape to go Cup racing. I feel like they have their program together better than anybody, and would be a legit, I don't know if they're going to be a contender, but you put them in a Cup series, and I feel like they would run mid-pack, not back in a pack.
I think it would be a struggle, kind of like what it was when they first started off in Xfinity 5 years ago. But then they had Blake Koch as their driver. And every year, I mean, they had Blake Koch for 2 years, Ryan Truex, then, you know, ran a part-time car, Justin Haley for 2 years, putting in part-time cars, now running three cars at times. Yeah, I agree with you, and I think they would make the move quickly. And they've tested it out. I mean, they ran the 500 with Justin Haley and ran well, so I wouldn't be surprised if they jumped a cup before long. And you know, who that's with, who knows, but they've got a good, very good Xfinity program, you know, for what they are. And they're a small team. They only have 30-something employees. It's not right. not that big. But, yeah, it was – I would imagine Ross Chastain's got to be getting pretty frustrated to be so close, yet not getting to victory lane. But now
you may end up winning the whole championship without winning a race. That'd be awesome.
Matt Crafton did it last year in the trucks. But the last stint of the race was set up by a late race caution for Brett Moffitt, who I think he made contact with Anthony Alfredo, maybe. And it looked like a fender, like they hit fenders. But turned out it broke something internally in the car. Because he dumped down a ton of oil on the track. Chase Briscoe, the leader at the time, dives off into turn one, wipes out. Alfredo then wrecks. Everyone's spinning out in it. I feel like this is something NASCAR can't miss because you could see on camera lenses that there was something on the track.
But you couldn't see it on the track.
That's true. That's a good point. But it's just, that's a tough situation. I don't know. Help me out here.
I mean, and I'll be in NASCAR's corner on this one. You couldn't see it on the track, which, if anything, made you think it was just water. And, yeah, water and not treaded tires don't go well together, but there's not – you can survive with a little moisture on a track, and it happens periodically in races. But, obviously, it was a fluid other than that because a bunch of people had trouble with it. You've got – NASCAR has spotters all the way around the track, and they look for this kind of stuff. And if you see discoloration coming out behind a vehicle or like when it happened, they showed the in-car camera with it getting on the lens, but all the way down the front stretch and into turn one, the TV panel, the back panel on the car was not discolored.
Right.
So you really didn't think that it was putting out anything that was going to be bad. And yet, man, they got to turn one and it turned ugly. And I hated that for Briscoe predominantly because – can you imagine how awesome that finish would have been with him
up there,
Hamlin, and Chastain all going at it? That could have been an epic finish to a race. So, it was disappointing, but I'm on NASCAR's side on this one. You couldn't see it on the track when it happened, and so I don't blame them for not throwing a caution.
Yeah, I would say under the yellow, you could see the TV panel of the 02 car, Brett Moffitt. It was brown.
Right.
But at the time, I mean, I thought it was a tire rub, personally. I didn't think there was any way. I mean, you bang fenders, we see it all the time. But it broke something in there. But I guess what I'm more upset or was furious about in the moment was they red flag the race, right? They're doing track cleanup. They get back under caution and run six laps under caution to put Speedy Dry down.
Yeah, don't even get me going on that, brother. You know how I feel on that crap.
What in the hell? You throw a red flag to clean up the track.
Perfect.
That's frustrating.
Done with the red flag, you come get the one to go, and you go race.
Or at least at the most two to go. At the most two to go. I agree. It should be one.
One to go.
I agree. Yeah. But if
you... and especially at that point right there, if you want to call quickie caution when they go back and make it two laps, because I don't remember if they let people pit before they red flagged it or not. Because ideally in that situation, let everybody go ahead and pit, then red flag it, and then you can turn around and you just go one to go, and we go race. But yeah, there's nothing. There's a lot of stuff that happens in NASCAR races that piss me off. There is nothing that makes me madder than red flagging a race and then you turn around and run 6, 8, 10 laps under caution when you go back to rolling.
You're just waste of laps. The red flags are designed. You throw a red flag to clean up the track. Plain and simple.
You don't go back to rolling until you're ready to go racing.
Which, at a track like Pocono, I'm thinking back, in the Xfinity Series and in the Truck Series, something similar happened, and they put down like a...
Oh, God, yeah.
A
beach. They put down enough Speedy Dry to freaking pave a road, and then they let them start rolling, and they ran like 8 laps at Pocono, which took like 40 minutes. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, so that I agree with you. Like, that's, there's a lot of things that can make you upset, but that's got to be up there.
Infuriates me.
Just doesn't make much sense, but regardless, it happened. And hey, if we have to live through that to get a finish like we did, I guess I'm okay with it.
No, still not okay with it.
All right. Anything else with the Xfinity race? I mean, I think we covered it all especially the finish, which was the best part.
Yeah, no, I thought it was a great race. I want more.
Cup needs this package, man. They need this package. Moving on to the truck race, Neff. Ben Rhodes gets the victory. Late race caution in the top three pit. Sheldon Creed, Brett Moffitt, and Austin Hill all pit. I was stunned, as there was only going to be a two-lap shootout when they go back green. So you're not going to make your way up from 10th, 12th. You can't pit.
Right. Completely agree. When I saw it happening, I'm like, okay, I understand the old leaders in a win situation kind of thing, that they do it and everybody else will do the opposite. And if the leader had stayed out, I might have understood a guy or two pitting. But the fact that the leader came and the two guys behind him came, I'm like, what in the wide world of sports is going on? And yeah, and it obviously played out exactly like we thought it would, that you didn't get the chance. I mean, if it had been 4 or 5 laps, completely understand it. Mm-hmm. No problem. But the fact that we were going overtime, it made zero sense. I mean, I know tires are a couple seconds, but
you got to get the traffic. You got to get the traffic too. And Austin Hill was the best of them, restarting 11th. He got up to 3rd in 2 laps, but he was still, I don't know, over a second behind Rhodes. So he got back to where he came in, so there's no net loss. But if he doesn't pit, he probably wins the race.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I get that. I don't know. I guess you're damned if you do, damned if you don't, if you're a leader. But ultimately, I mean, a lot of people did pit.
Yeah.
The top 10 did not. Which I think there was, I don't know, probably 20 cars on the lead lap at the time. So, I don't know, it's probably half and half, split strategy. Ultimately, though, Sheldon Creed, who was leading the race, shot himself in the foot because he spun on pit road. So, he finished 18th.
Yeah.
So, that's a double whammy. But for Ben Rhodes, this is a long time coming. It's been over 2 years since he won. Snapped a 48-race winless streak. He's been kind of quietly consistent this year. And now 3 of the 4 Thor Sport trucks have won, Neff. And Johnny Sauter's radio on Sunday was something to listen
Johnny
to.
Johnny Sauter gold, man. It was Johnny Sauter gold. If you're not familiar with Johnny Sauter radio, first of all, if you're under 18, you should not listen to it because it is R/X-rated most of the time. I've seen some videos in my life of people that come up with interesting and unique ways to use the F word. There's nobody better at it than Johnny Sauter. If you're a fan of Christmas Story like I am, and they talk about his old man working in cursing like the masters worked in oils, Johnny Sauter is that way. I mean, that dude can cuss better than anybody. I mean, I've seen him at Martinsville leading by like 4 seconds. I mean, smoking the place. And he is cussing a blue streak like somebody just shot his dog. It is golden. And he was in typical, beautiful, rare form at Darlington because things did not go his way.
Yeah, I tweeted out some of them that had a lot of expletives in them. But, yeah, it is, if you're under 18, bring earmuffs because you probably should not be listening to it. But I don't know. He was running. He ended up blowing an engine, and he was down a cylinder for a lot of the final stage, if not longer. But another race where he's just terrible. And, you know, he's in a must-win at Richmond, which, sure, he can win. Johnny Sauter's kind of like Kyle Busch in the sense that he can win any race. We saw that in Michigan. Probably should have won that race. I talked to him about it a couple weeks ago for a story that came out last week on Front Stretch. Made a mistake and under his teammate ran on a finger and wrecked when he probably could have and should have won the race, but woulda, shoulda, coulda. But yeah, his audio, even if he's first or he's 31st, I'm tuning in because you get a lot of good stuff on the 13
it's
radio.
Phenomenal, man. It is so phenomenal. I mean, and some of you may have listened in the past when Kenny Wallace was a racer at the NASCAR level. Kenny could be that way too. I mean, he wasn't at Johnny's level, but on a bad day, Kenny could come up with some really creative ways to curse. And that's why it used to always be fun to listen to his radio too. But I'm a huge Johnny Sauter radio fan. I still feel there should be a Race Hub After Dark or something where they do Radioactive Tuesday, and they would be able to play, you know, the full unedited expletive laced versions of radios, and Sauter would be a mainstay on that every time.
He really would be. So I don't know. Going into this weekend at Richmond, you know, no spoilers, but maybe he'll get the win when we have predictions coming up. Now, that's all I have for Darlington, but I think
I got one more thing for trucks at Darlington.
Sure.
Huge thumbs up to Tyler Ankrum. I'm a bit of an Ankrum fan because I remember seeing him running super late models at Nashville years ago. But dude's never been on a track in his life. They drop the green flag. He goes three wide on the flat, going through one and two, and gain like 8 spots. And then literally every restart after that, I watched for him, and he made the same move every time. I'm like, this guy is insane. So I got to give Tyler Ankrum a shout-out because literally you've never been at Darlington, and you hear all the stories and all the too tough to tame and stripes, and you got to stay out of the wall, blah, blah, blah. And he sails it to the bottom in one and two and goes flying by people and made it out of two. Because I'm watching him when it happened, and I'm like, this dude is going to pound the wall in turn two. Came off and just kept right on digging. So got to give him a shout out because that was, other than the finish of the Xfinity race, that was one of the highlights of my whole weekend at Darlington, seeing Ankrum going on the flat one and two.
Must have been something he tried on a simulator because that's like you said, tough to do at Darlington when you've never been on the track. He did spin out later in the race, but ultimately came back with a respectable finish and heads into the regular season finale this week at Richmond, 14 points above the cutoff. So I will get into predictions here in a little bit. But Neff, off the track, reports came out Tuesday as we record this that NASCAR is looking to reconfigure Auto Club Speedway and turning into a half-mile short track. Essentially, it would use the part of the front stretch and then pit road, and it would have long straightaways like Martinsville, banked at 11 degrees, but then also banked corners like Bristol. We talked a little bit about this before we, you know, started recording, but what's your thoughts on this idea for a possible reconfiguration Auto Club Speedway?
I can't even believe I'm going to say this, but I'm kind of sad to see Auto Club go, which for most of its life I would have never said because I've always not been a fan of Auto Club. I love Michigan, and somewhere in the last 8 or 9 years, those two tracks switched positions.
Yeah.
And I have loved Auto Club, and I have hated Michigan because since they repaved Michigan, it just hasn't worn out. And you still don't have people running all the way at the wall. I think we're a dozen years since the repave. It's been a long time. And for whatever reason, Auto Club, with the age and the character and the bumps and everything, it's really been putting on good racing. But that said, it's not far from a repave. And a repave at a 2 mile racetrack is a truckload of money.
Mm-hmm.
And if you repave it, you're going to spend 6 to 10 years waiting for it to age to get back to the racing we've currently got there. So why not take a similar amount of money, maybe a little bit more, but it's going to be about the same, and build this whole new track because NASCAR fans have told you they want more short tracks. So let's put a short track on the West Coast. Ideally, I would have rather seen them just go to Irwindale because I think Irwindale is a great track. NASCAR doesn't own it. They own this. It not only gives us a short track, which I'm really kind of excited to see because I'm trying to visualize a short track like Martinsville with a straightaways banked like Dover and a corners banked like Bristol. It seems like a recipe for disaster, so I'm dying to actually see it happen. But it also gives NASCAR a different revenue stream because having a half mile, you don't have the footprint of a 2 mile. So there's a bunch of land around the backstretch of this place that they're going to be able to turn into warehouses or shops or factories or whatever, and give them an alternative revenue stream while still putting on cup races. So as much as I hate to see Auto Club go away, I think the timing is about perfect for it. And there are worse decisions. I hope that this goes well and they immediately decide to do the same thing to Chicagoland, because I'm scared that Chicagoland's going away, and I would love to see Chicagoland turned into a half-mile or three-quarter-mile track as well.
Yeah, and something like this came out about Chicagoland earlier this year, and we saw kind of a carbon footprint of it, just like we did with Auto Club that came out today. And yeah, I'm worried about Chicagoland too, because in both these tracks are, you know, especially Auto Club, have old asphalt, put on some tremendous racing. I mean, who can forget Chicagoland, Kyle Larson, Kyle Busch a couple years ago? But with Auto Club specifically, it kind of bums me out that it's Auto Club, because it is one of the tracks that is the most raciest on the circuit. You can go from below the apron to right against the wall, that which we see, especially on restarts, 6-7 wide. So that is kind of a bummer. And there's so many short tracks around the country that maybe NASCAR doesn't own, or maybe they do own, that I feel like we could have gone to. So, but I get that we can't lose that Los Angeles market either, because that's also another revenue stream. And if we lose Chicago, which is the third biggest market, we sure as hell can't lose the second biggest market in the United States, which is Los Angeles. So I guess whatever saves racing out there. And also, if this comes to fruition in a few years, which it would take a few years to develop, it gets a short track out west instead of three in about, what, a couple hundred miles of one another in Virginia and Tennessee. So, yeah, I don't know. Look, it looks interesting from the layout I saw, you said.
Absolutely.
So, if it leads to good racing and, you know, keeping the market there, then I'm all for it. And why not give it a try?
I feel like they're going to destroy a lot of cars. And talk as we might about wanting to see good racing all the time, the fans and the ratings have proven that if you tear up a bunch of stuff, they will come. So yeah. I think that place will tear up a bunch of stuff. We will wait and see. But it's, like I said, I hope it's a step in that direction. And maybe the folks at SMI will take a note of this. And I mean, Jeff Burton has espoused it for a while, and I was on board with it even before he started talking about it. Take, you know, Texas, Kentucky, Vegas, and again, Vegas is one of our better, you know, aged racetracks as well. Even Atlanta, turn the corners faster, make your backstretch go right behind where the garages are, and you have a 3/4 to 7/8 mile racetrack. I would love to see three or four. Well, let's not go to four. Let's say three of the SMI mile and a half get turned into 3/4, 7/8 mile tracks. I think would be fantastic. But I suppose this is a bit of a trial balloon that NASCAR's playing up here, and we'll go down the road and see how this unveils.
Yeah, and fans crave, you know, more short tracks. Well, if that's what we get, then I think it's a win. And if we get multiple, then that's even a bigger win. So, as we've seen over the years, they put on some of the best racing. And with that said, Neff, we're going to Richmond, another short track this weekend. First time we've been there this year since the spring day got moved. And there's a lot of racing. We got four races between trucks, the doubleheader and Xfinity, and Cup on Saturday. So, we got, as I mentioned, the regular season finale for the Truck Series on Thursday. You got Tyler Ankrum up 14 points on Derek Kraus for the final playoffs. Well, I guess the second to final playoff spot. Todd Gilliland up 10 for the final. So two of these guys are likely going to get in, unless you got someone like Johnny Sauter or Stuart Friesen get a victory, or, you know, someone 10th on back, 11th on back. So who you got winning the truck race at Richmond?
I'm going to keep beating this dead horse, man. I am on the Johnny Sauter bandwagon. He's really good at Richmond.
Yep.
I just, at some point, the luck's got to turn around for him. And with Rhodes winning last week, I feel like the ThorSport guys, I just can't fathom the playoffs happening and Sauter being the only ThorSport guy that doesn't make it.
Yeah.
So I feel like this is, and he obviously has to win to get in. He's 130
he's way out there
points or whatever back, so it's got to happen. But that's my pick. I'm It's like win with the Biff. I'm going to keep riding Sauter until he wins a race.
Yeah, and he's one of the few truck guys that have experience there. He won an Xfinity race in 2003 at Richmond. So, yeah, it won't surprise me if he goes out and dominates. It also won't surprise me if he runs 20th all day. I mean, that's just been the Johnny Sauter way this year.
Or, like, breaks an axle.
Yeah, something crazy happens. Yeah. I'm not going to go Johnny Sauter. It is weird, though, to think that he won't make the playoffs if he doesn't obviously get the victory. I'm going to go Zane Smith. He's been getting hot lately. He's got a couple wins. He also ran in Xfinity at Richmond last year and ran respectable for Junior Motorsports.
Really I got good on short track.
Yeah.
Short
track. I got Zane Smith getting his third victory of the season. Neff, going into Friday, the first of two races this weekend at Richmond for that series to make up a race. As they've got two to make up. Who you got and get to victory lane in the first race on Friday?
I'll let you take the first one because I think I know who you want and I don't want to take your pick.
I don't know. I don't even know who I'd go with. I'm going to go with Allgaier. I don't know if you thought I was going to go with him or not.
No, I thought you were going Chastain, and that's what I was wanting Chastain, but I didn't want to take him if you were going to take him. I feel like Chastain, like we just said, is so due. I feel like he's going to get it done.
I'm going to go Allgaier. Chastain's a good pick. Allgaier's, dominated some races there in the past. A couple races.
Yeah, he's good at Richmond.
It's kind of like Phoenix, shorter track, Richmond being a short track, and flat, and those are the tracks that he's good at. So I got Justin Allgaier winning the first race of the doubleheader. Second race, though, I don't know. I feel like... Briscoe's going to be good. You're going to have your regular Cindric. I'll go Chastain for the second race. How about that? You get him first, and I'll get him second race.
That works. I'm going Briscoe. I think when you give that team a chance to work on the car and come back a second day, I think Briscoe gets it.
10-4. And then we got the Cup race on Saturday night, following the Xfinity race. Second race in the round of 16. I kind of spoiled my pick earlier, Neff. I think I know where you're going since you kind of laid out your whole playoffs last week.
I did.
But I'm going to go Martin Truex Jr. As I mentioned, he's been like the epitome of solid at Richmond over the years. But he's only got two wins in the last two races last year. So I got Truex winning on Saturday night.
Yeah, and you can't go to Richmond and not just remember how bad Truex just got screwed. Mm-hmm. In his career by that whole itchy arm thing with Boyer.
Yeah. I mean, Seven years ago.
It doesn't matter how long ago it was, it still bugs the hell out of me because I just think he absolutely got thrown under the bus for no reason because it was nothing of his doing. He did everything he had to do and he got hosed.
Yeah.
So I always like to see him do well at Richmond to kind of flip the finger at those guys that all screwed him over. I laid it out last week, and I'm sticking to it. I think Kyle Busch wins this week and next week and sets himself up for the round of 12.
Spoiler, next week. You already got your – I mean, you laid out the whole playoff. So if you go back and listen to last week's episode, Neff's got every week for the next nine now. Neff, any final thoughts before we get to DiBenedetto?
No, it's love having Matty D on the show. He's an awesome interview. I've watched him since he was running the late models ages ago. Saw somebody try to get in a fight with his dad on the front stretch at Martinsville when it was so dark you couldn't even see the cars at the end of the race. That was a long time ago. But he's a great dude. Racing at Darlington's awesome. Racing at Richmond is awesome. I'm pumped up for just the playoffs in general. I'm not a fan of the playoffs. I still wish we did it old school way. But the first two rounds this year in the playoffs are really awesome. And looking forward to Richmond. It was my favorite track for many years on schedule, and it's still in a top three.
Yeah, and we talked about that with DiBenedetto. I talked to him last Friday. I prefaced that earlier, but I want to preface it again because it's a good thing we talked to him prior to Darlington because, as we mentioned in the body of the podcast, not a good race for the 21 team, finishing 21st. But really, these first two rounds set up nicely with him. He's got he's ran well at Richmond and underfunded equipment in the past. We know how good he is at Bristol. In the second round, you look at Vegas, finished second there in the spring. You got Talladega, which is a good super speedway driver. And you also got the Roval, and he's proven to be pretty, pretty crafty on road courses, too. So, Neff, let's get to our conversation with Matt DiBenedetto. All right, Matt, you're in the postseason for the first time. On a personal level, what's this mean to you as a race car driver?
It means a lot. You know, I think my career path has always, you know, been filled with a lot of ups and downs and fighting and clawing to get here. So, you know, you really appreciate all the accomplishments so much more. And then on top of that, doing it, driving for the Wood Brothers makes it, you know, way extra special. So it's cool. It meant a whole lot to me and my family. And obviously I feel like we're just getting started. Glad we made them, because I think we can really perform and do a good job in the playoffs too. Not only just be there.
For sure. And you've never been in a position like this, you know, obviously before this year of making the playoffs, especially straight up on points. So how nerve-wracking were the, you know, last couple of weeks of the regular season, whether it's at the Daytona Road Course, Dover, and then I guess last weekend at Daytona?
Well, it's funny you ask, because, you know, there was a kind of that mid-stretch of the season where I felt like we really got our stuff together as a team. We were executing well, and we were running up front every race. You know, we got like eight stages where we got stage points in a row and finished top five, top ten, all that. So I was like, all right, we're really getting in a rhythm now. And I was like, points wise, I think we're gonna be great. And then we got a stretch where, well, we had we got crashed running fourth at Texas, and then Austin Dillon ended up winning, so that bumped us back in points. Then Cole Custer won a race, bumped us back. You know, and we're like, uh-oh, and then, but still, we were running well, we just had a couple weeks of bad luck, and then we went to, you know, we just started having some things go wrong, some out of our control, then we go to Dover, and they had a 40-something point advantage, which we're like, we kind of lost some of our gap, but it's all right, and then Dover was our worst track of the year, so then we lost all our gap going into Daytona, and it just made it really stressful.
Matt, when you get closer to the bubble, and like I said, this is really the first time you've been in that position, how uncomfortable is that?
Oh, man, just ask my wife. She's sitting right here next to me. She she could tell you even better than me just how, I mean, she couldn't even, the week leading up to the Daytona race, I couldn't even have our Zoom meetings, our team calls and meetings in front of her. Because she was such a nervous wreck, she would just start crying, just hearing our preparation and, you know, how important it was and the nerves. So it was pretty stressful, you know, especially for her. For me, I think I've been through a lot of stressful situations in my career, so they've kind of groomed me for moments like that, situations like that, where I knew that I can only just focus on what's in my control, and I had to be the guy to stay calm and cool and collected and just go do my job.
Because you hadn't been in this position before, running for a single car team, I know you have the alliance, obviously, with Penske. So who were you leaning on for advice, or were you leaning on anyone for advice leading into the I guess, the regular season finale?
You know, I think mostly, I think Brad gave some good advice on as far as, you know, how we were going to work together and how they were going to try and, you know, do things to help us or just not put me in a bad position, you know, in the race, knowing our situation. So that was helpful. And then as far as my end, just, you know, really watching a lot of film, preparing, studying, doing the things that, you know, I should do to be the most prepared for super speedways. Although I actually wasn't happy with my performance on track because me personally, because it was really a weird dynamic paying attention to two guys at a race, a super speedway race like Daytona. I mean, it affected some of my decision making, and I wasn't happy with how I did. But at the end of the day, I was glad it all worked out exactly like it did, and I can learn from it and move forward. But I was just glad we made the playoffs, so I wouldn't change a thing of how it worked out. But and also, my spotter Doug Campbell really, really does a good job, and I'm so thankful that him and I worked together so well.
So you mentioned the Zoom meetings, you know, going into last week. How much, you have the alliance, like I mentioned, with Team Penske. How much are you, like, how limited is the face-to-face interaction this year because of COVID?
Oh, a lot. That's the hardest part. One of the hardest parts for me is kind of my MO is any team I go to, I dump a lot of time into just spending time at the shop around the guys, even, you know, going to lunch with them weekly, hanging out, just that camaraderie, you know, and obviously your work stuff too, and spending time in person with your crew chief, team, whatever. All that's pretty much gone this year. I don't get to go to the shop hardly at all. So really it's just at the track, you know, seeing your team a little bit, but it's not anything like I'm accustomed to. And that's usually been a real big deal for me, and a part of, you know, building that kind of family, you know, feel as a team and camaraderie. So that's been a tough challenge, and something I can't wait till it gets back to normal, because, you know, that really builds a great environment and team feeling when you can spend a lot of time with your guys.
For sure. Now, you mentioned how, you know, you've been through stressful moments before and a lot of pressure, but you mentioned a NASCAR media day for the playoffs media day, that the Wood Brothers told you prior to Daytona, the regular season finale, to, you know, there was no pressure. If you make it, you make it. So how much more relaxed were you because of that?
You know, just having that support system behind you is, it means more than people could possibly imagine, you know, going, I've always been big on, you know, a team to me means having each other's backs no matter what. And driving for the Woods, you know, when you drive for them, you are literally part of their family. And it's a special feeling, and it's so different than anything else. So it just makes a difference. It's more comforting driving the car, like knowing, hey, I've got this family behind me 100%. I can go out there and just focus on doing my job. So it's a special feeling driving for the Wood family. And that was really neat, having all of them call me the week of and just saying, hey, you know, we got your back. Don't worry about it. Just focus on what's in your control. Go do your best. You've done a great job this year. We're especially, you know, 2020 being a kind of a wild year with a lot of variables we didn't expect. They're like, you know, if you make it, that's great. If you don't, it's not the end of the world. Just go do the best you can. That's all we can ask for. And that was just really special. And obviously, you know, I'm a really competitive guy. And I'm like, we better make the playoffs. That was our goal starting the season. We shouldn't even be this close, you know. But I'm glad we made them. And now, because obviously we can, I feel like we can do a good job and really go perform in them. But it's nice having that support.
Yeah. So you're in, obviously, as the 16th and final seed. So are you kind of playing with nothing to lose?
Yeah, I'd say a little bit, because, you know, we've had some things lately in our season that just where things weren't going real great, falling away, bad luck, you know, this and that. So now that we're in, it's like, all right, we get a fresh start here a little bit, get back on track like we were at the midpoint of the season, and go try and kick some butt. And it's just everything's a bonus at this point. So it's just nice for us that we get that bit of a reset points.
Realistically, a lot of people, I mean, let's be honest, probably have you out in the first couple of rounds. So, of course, you want to win the title, Matt. But what are your goals for your first playoff?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm a realistic guy. I mean, obviously, we are racing for a championship. We're in the playoffs. But, you know, and everybody has a chance. You never know what can happen. You win, you're in the next round. It's a cool format. But, you know, I'm realistic. We're a new group working together this year. 2020 is throwing a lot of variables in there. We still have improvements to make, you know, and things we can get better at as a team. Looking forward to, you know, like next year and things like that. Just we got to continue building as a team. We're not quite at our full potential yet. But I would say, I don't know how to put a number on it. It's great we made the playoffs, but obviously we all want more and know that we're capable of more is the important thing. So I would say I'd love to make it through at least a round or two and compete right on the end. To say that we're going to beat Denny Hamlin and Kevin Harvick is a bit of a stretch. Those guys are obviously incredibly good. They have a big points buffer. We'd have to have a lot of things really go our way to make it to the final four. But I think I look at it, and we're grouped together really close with a lot of cars in points that I think know that we're capable of beating. So we can just if we can go out there, have solid races, put everything together, maybe sneak a win in there, which we're capable of as well, especially at some of these tracks coming up. A lot of 750 horsepower, low downforce tracks, which are, you know, right up our alley. I think we can go out there and perform.
And on top of that, it seems like the first couple of rounds especially kind of suit your style. You know, from the outside looking in, I know you've overachieved at Richmond before, Bristol, you almost won last August. And then the second round, Vegas, you finished, what, second in the spring, and then you've run well at Talladega, and you're a good road course driver. So, I don't know. It seems like you're kind of a dark horse, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'd like to agree. I feel the same way, because we look at the schedule, and that was another reason, on top of the many. But I was like, man, we better make the playoffs, because we've got good racetracks where we can really go out and perform at. So I'm pretty pumped about that.
So you've got this year you got a pair of top fives. So what do you feel like's missing to take that next step, though, and run more consistently inside the top five and lead more laps?
I think just continuing to work on some of our communication and execution, our race execution as a team. You know, it's been hard without practice and qualifying in the normal schedule. So I think we still have room for improvement there. The guys on pit road have been working hard and getting better. And so it just, you know, when you're racing, that's the thing, is when you start racing up in the top five, the top 10, I mean, it just gets where everything has to be so perfect. So we're, it takes everybody. It's not just me as a driver. I mean, it's my whole team. Now the guys in the shop, the, you know, engineers, a lot of pressure on them, which, you know, been doing a great job of starting off with close setups. A lot of pressure on the guys on pit road and my crew chief. I mean, you name it. I'm just one piece to the puzzle, and we're all continuing to grow together and get this team to where we can be winning races and running up at the very front consistently.
So I'm kind of curious, because you hear guys like Corey LaJoy wonder, what if he gets into a good car? So for you, right, so you went from Go Fast to Levine Family Racing, which is a step up, and then obviously another step up to the Wood Brothers. So I'm curious, Matt, how long does it take to adjust to the better equipment?
It's funny. It's kind of just all relative. When you get in the better equipment, I think driving the underfunded stuff really helps to prepare you, because you have to make absolutely everything out of what you're driving. Mm. So that helps to prepare you for these types of situations, I think. But as far as driving the car, you don't drive the car any different. You just are running a little further up in the pack, or a lot further up in the pack. You know, it's just the car just naturally has a little bit more speed in it, and you're just racing around guys further up front. So that's kind of nice, and shows the work of the team and how much speed they build in these race cars, things like that. But my past experience is what's really taught me a lot.
So as a driver, with how your career's kind of gone, you know, upward on the trajectory level, how much more confidence do you have going into the track this year because of your past?
A lot. You know, I'll be honest with you. I'm just a very realistic and honest guy. I wouldn't have been ready for an opportunity like this, like driving the 21 car back, you know, my first year or two of Cup. There's right. No way I could have made near as much out of it. And we still have a long ways to go. But just stepping into that opportunity, I'm much more capable now of coming in and being like, all right, here's what I see. We need to continue to get better. You know, I'm much more mature, and I can really evaluate things. I drive with a much more level head, you name it. So I'm just appreciative of being able to have driven for smaller underfunded teams and learn all these experiences and how to make the most of what I have and get a ton of seat time to where when I do get this type of opportunity, it really makes me more prepared.
All right, man, I'll get you out here in this one. It's a fan question from at Corbin Wesley, the Twitter handle. And Wesley wants to know, it's a non-racing question, how well-behaved is your dog, Brian?
That's a good one. Brian, I'm going to give him, honestly, not being biased because he's our dog, and everyone else that meets him says the same thing, I'd give him a 10 out of 10 on incredible behavior, because he is fully trained. On and off leash obedience, trained by our friend dogs by Andy in Mooresville, and his temperament is amazing. He's a really chill dog, just loves to hang around. He's a great nap partner. So Brian is the ultimate perfect dog.
Sounds like a good dog, Matt. Dogs are awesome. So appreciate your time today. Good luck in the playoffs. Okay.
All right. Thanks, Dustin. I appreciate it.
All right, y'all. There you have it. Good conversation there with Matt DiBenedetto, which, as I mentioned twice during the taping of the podcast, was prior to Darlington, which, following the Southern 500, the 21 team now sits a tied 15th in points with Ryan Blaney, 17 markers out of the top 12 to advance to the round of 12. So luckily for De Benedetto, he's performed well on short tracks in the past, which makes up the final two races of the first round. So a good run this weekend at Richmond could catapult him into success at Bristol, which he damn near won the night race of Bristol last August. Fun conversation there with Neff, too, about all things Darlington. Personally, I always enjoy racing at Darlington, watching it as a viewer, seeing the all-throttle time, especially in the Xfinity Series. Truly think that race was as good as it gets. Drivers could pass, there were carts that were ill-handling, and just truly a great race from start to finish. But that's it for this week's show. Head on over to Apple Podcasts and help us out. Give us a nice rating and review. Tell us you'd like to see it on the podcast, and all the feedback is greatly appreciated. There's a lot of racing at Richmond this weekend, and you know we'll be here next week to break it all down. But until then, we out.